Senator Jeanne Forrester, welcome to Morning Edition.
Thank you.
Let's start with the substance abuse crisis in the state, which will be one of the top priorities for the next governor. How do you see your approach to the issue differing from that of your opponents?
I would say that probably I have more and more in-depth experience on this particular issue. I sit on the Governor's Commission for Drug and Alcohol Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, have for the last 4 years. I also led in the Senate 4 years ago to get more funding for prevention education for youth in our schools. And so I think I have a really good understanding of what's happening in the state, having been kind of on the front lines of that issue. I was the last candidate to get into the race and the first one to lay out a plan that talks about how we take back New Hampshire from this heroin and opioid epidemic that we're facing.
I did want to follow up with on that a little bit. You've talked about public awareness programs targeting mm-hmm. the state's youth, as you just mentioned. What would that look like?
Sure. So in my plan, I talk about prevention, education, enforcement, and treatment and recovery. On the prevention education side, I think what we need to do, and this is talking with superintendents, principals, substance abuse counselors, and others about what that would look like, is a prevention education program that starts early and often K through 12, consistent and age appropriate through the grades. It needs to be science-based so that young people aren't just being told to stay off drugs. They're being taught the science behind why they need to stay off drugs and what will happen if they start to do drugs, what that will lead to and what that will look like for them in their life.
You'd be in favor of a statewide curriculum on that?
I would be in well, let me just say this. I'm very much in support of local control. And so I would want to have the communities weigh in on this and be part of the process of what that program would look like. And that doesn't mean we have to reinvent the wheel either. There are other good programs out there. For example, Life of an Athlete, which is a prevention education program that we funded 4 years ago. And that is in the schools now, and actually what the schools are doing, it was based on a certain type of program, but their schools are modifying it to fit their particular community and their culture. And I think that's important to have communities be part of that process.
You've talked a bit in the past about the possibility of deploying National Guard members to the border to help with you know, policing the border. Do you still see that as a possibility?
Yeah. Yes. And actually, I might have been just a little inartful about the way that I kind of explained that. But let me be a little more clear about it. Since 1989, we have been using National Guard for our counter drug program. It's a program that the governors, all 50 governors of our states, execute this program. We're doing it now. The latest analysis that I saw, it's called a high intensity drug traffic area, identifies the Mass border as where we're seeing the most drugs happening. We're using National Guard during Bike Week in Laconia when there are high incidences of drugs. So it's being done now. It's actually being done in Manchester. So what I was talking about was using all the tools in our toolbox and having that support if we need it and talking to law enforcement, certainly the Commissioner of Safety and others, about how they would see that helping them to address this issue.
But, of course, there's always going to be demand, and where there's demand, there will be a way. You know, talking about prevention efforts, how do you see the state's role in helping with addiction recovery services?
And addiction recovery services are certainly important, as is treatment. And we know that over the years, we've lost treatment beds. I have mentioned before that I worked for Odyssey House, a drug and alcohol residential treatment facility for youth, many years ago. That program is gone now, whether it's through insurance not covering it or the state not funding it, the program has ended. And so those beds have gone away. We need to make sure that when folks are ready to be in treatment, go through recovery, that we have the beds and the recovery centers in place for them to take advantage of that. So, and until we have those treatment beds and the appropriate number, we should, I would, as governor, develop relationships with other states who have good programs so that we can be at the top of the list, if you will, so that there when there is a person who needs treatment and who's ready to get treatment, that we have that ability to get them into a treatment program somewhere else if we don't have the beds available here.
Let's talk a bit about health care. You voted for Medicaid expansion in 2014, but now you say you would let the current program end when it expires at the end of 2017. This is a program that some 50,000 Granite Staters now rely on. What would be the alternative?
Sure. And let me start by saying this. My philosophy is this. I believe, and I believe most Granite Staters feel the same way, that everyone should have access to high-quality health care in the state of New Hampshire. The bill that I voted on in 2014 is very different than the bill that I voted on this time. The bill in 2014 was 100% federally funding. Fast forward to this budget cycle, $35 million the taxpayers of the state of New Hampshire would be on the hook for. So I did vote against that. I brought in an amendment and asked that there was a work requirement. That was rejected. And I voted against the bill. In terms of what we would do going forward, I do have concerns because even with the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, people are falling through the cracks. They're not getting the help they need. And what I did was introduce legislation to look at voluntary health care as a potential way to address those folks who are not getting the care they need. They're doing it in Florida very successfully. I don't know if you've heard about this program, but essentially it indemnifies healthcare providers, dentists, medical professionals who would volunteer their time, and the state indemnifies them. In Florida, they're doing it, and I think they've provided since 2010 $2.6 billion in free health care to over 400,000 people.
Do you have numbers to show that that's a program that could be translated to a smaller, more rural state like New Hampshire?
And that's a very good question. And so I introduced the legislation, and it was turned into a study committee, and I will be on that committee this fall because Florida is very different from New Hampshire.
Sure.
And we need to make sure that it fits New Hampshire's community culture and the demographics of New Hampshire. And so we've made sure that in building that study committee that all the stakeholders who need to be on that committee weigh in and talk about this and how it would work and if it would work for the state of New Hampshire.
You were one of two Republican candidates that have signed the pledge with Americans for Prosperity. The conservative group, one of those pledges you made is to oppose any Affordable Care Act-related programs like Medicaid expansion. Now, two of your opponents, Chris Nunu and Ted Gatzis, did not sign the pledge, mm-hmm. saying that they didn't want to tie their hands on the issue. Do you see their point? I mean, is there something there that
I don't see their point, and I'll tell you why, because what they will say in forums and debates that I've been at is that they won't support a sales or an income tax or any new increases in taxes and fees. And the way this program is headed right now, I have great concerns about what it's going to lead to in the state of New Hampshire. And by not committing to signing this pledge, they have I left the door open for increased sales or an income tax or new taxes and fees.
You don't see it as an ideological point of view, though, before you get into office, before knowing all the conditions that may come up during your term as governor?
I don't see it that way.
No.
No. Just based on the experience that I've had over the time that I've been in the Senate and knowing kind of the moving parts of how this has been put together and the concerns I have in terms of, you know, will the hospitals, will the insurance providers be able to come up with that $35 million? And I think you probably saw on the front page of the newspaper today, one of the hospitals has got some issues. And I've heard it from at least one of the hospitals in my district, the concern about being able to fund that $35 million.
Let's talk a bit about the state's economy. One of the issues facing the state is a shortage of skilled workers. We hear that from business owners in many places, at least in the southern tier. You've talked about your plan for a career partnership program. Can you explain how that would work?
Sure. So I would take that idea to the state level. When I was the Main Street director in Meredith, we were experiencing a problem with the local businesses, the retail the hotels and the restaurants getting the help they needed. And of course, we had young people in high school who were out for the summer who couldn't get jobs because they didn't have the skills they needed. And so we worked with the business community to identify what those gaps were, whether it was communication skills or how to count or how to communicate or how to show up on time for work.
Some rudimentary skills.
Right. That's what we did with the Career Partnership Program. It's been working very successfully. I would take that program on a statewide level and elevate it in terms of, let's say, the company down the street who needs CNC machinists, okay? That we get into the schools early. We talk to the young people about potential careers. That doesn't mean you have to go to a four-year college to be a successful person. That there are other opportunities available to them, and that being a CNC machinist can be a good-paying job for you. And what does that mean? But it's expanding their kind of awareness of what's out there beyond a four-year college education.
Beyond the business development in those skilled worker positions, which are usually in the southern tier of the state, in the more populous areas, what about plans for the North Country? Obviously, a lot of stagnation there over the years.
There is a lot of stagnation, and there's a lot going on in the North Country, a lot of great people up there, opportunities. I believe that, and one of the things I've said I would do as governor is in the first 100 days, is convene a 10-county summit. So each county, I would go around and I would bring in the elected officials, the local leaders, and talk about what we can do as a state to help them, help them be economically viable. I believe they need to have a hand in the process. They know what's best. I've learned that on Main Street with small communities. The communities know best what's going to work for them. Talk to them and get their ideas about how we help them, but not how we reduce the hurdles and get out of the way of helping them be economically viable. And so really having them weigh in and talk about what does that mean for them? What does that look like?
What about your priorities when it does come to education? We touched a little bit about that, but, you know, talking about kindergarten, Common Core standards, where do you stand
sure.
on some of those issues?
So I have said that I don't support Common Core. As I go around and talk with parents and hear their concerns about Common Core, it seems to the Common Core is actually pulling parents away from their students or their children, and we need to have them be closer to helping and working with their children. I believe parents need to have choice. I'm a founding member of a charter school in Franklin, Compass Classical Academy. I believe parents, whether it's a private school, public school, homeschool, charter school, parents need to have that choice, and I support that idea.
You've made clear you are a pro-life candidate, but are there changes that you would want to make to current state law when it comes to abortion?
I think right now I am a pro-life candidate, and I think if there's legislation that leads to late-term abortions or fetal homicide, I've been in support of those kinds of legislation in the past and would be in the future.
Over the past two decades, Republicans have only held the corner office for 2 years in total. Why are you the leader that will put a Republican back in the governor's office?
So the last 9 out of 10 elections, Republicans have lost the corner office, and I believe it's because we keep putting up the same type of traditional candidate. And that's not to say anything wrong with the type of folks that we put up before, but clearly—
Who is that traditional candidate?
Well, the traditional candidate is establishment. It's somebody who's part, in my opinion, part of kind of that good old boy network. I think we need somebody that we can put up who can win in a general election. We need somebody different. When you look at my background as compared to the other folks in this race, certainly I have the most experience on the budget process, being the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. I come from community. I've worked and fought for community for the last 6 years in the Senate. What I have said is I believe we need somebody who comes from community, who understands Main Street, who understands local government, and will fight for the people and not be part of the establishment and not be afraid to buck the establishment.
Is it hard to say that you're outside the establishment when you've been in state government for several years?
Certainly not. It's not at all for me because, again, if you look at my record, it would prove out that I am not part of the establishment. I fought the establishment. I fought the lobbyists when it came to protecting private property rights. One of the first votes I cast when I was a freshman senator, 23-1 against Democrats and Republicans, on a piece of legislation that I had heard from my communities would hurt them, would downshift to them. So I think that proves, and certainly as a freshman Republican, you can imagine taking that step out against everyone else. So I'm not afraid to do that. I listen to the people, I talk with people, I represent communities, and we need somebody in the corner office who's going to be conservative and who's going to have conservative principles and really bring forward conservative change in the corner office.
Let's backtrack a little bit. I want to ask you about putting together your first budget proposal as governor. What would be at the top of your list in terms of priorities or issues that you'd want to see addressed?
I think, first of all, we want to make sure we have good revenue estimates. That's always important to get that from Ways and Means about what the revenue estimates look like. And then we want to prioritize what we believe are the most important issues in the state of New Hampshire. And for me, I think we absolutely need to take care of our most vulnerable citizens, whether it's seniors, whether it's developmentally disabled. We need to make sure that that they are taken care of. I think I would encourage more on looking at how we become more business friendly. Are we on track as we reduce the business profits tax and the business enterprise tax for the state of New Hampshire? Certainly we know in this budget that we brought forward that the governor said would lead to a $90 million hole that we're actually ahead in revenue estimates. So we know that's working, and we need to continue to monitor that and continue moving forward, because I believe that if we continue to become more business friendly in the state, our revenues will increase, and it will be there will be more prosperity, more good jobs for everyone in the state.
But what are those ways specifically that you would like to see the state become more business friendly?
Sure. So again, looking at continuing the reduction in the business profits tax and the business enterprise tax, reducing regulation. One of the things I've said that I would do probably in the first 100 days is bring together small, medium, and large businesses, sort of a networking committee to look at the rules and regulations, excuse me, and the hurdles that are getting in front of businesses. I think about the guy who gave me a call who wanted to open a hotel and was running into some real challenges with one of our local state agencies because the T's weren't crossed and the I's weren't dotted perfectly. And we want to be sure that we're balanced about that we're following the rules and regulations, but we want to be more responsive to small businesses, because here was a business that was going to create jobs, will create jobs in a small community, and everybody was excited about it. But the project was getting delayed and delayed and delayed because of minor issues that should not have been in the way. And so those are the types of things when we work with, when you bring forward that networking group of businesses who can talk about their experiences and really bring them together with state government officials so they understand what's happening. Because I believe everybody wants the same thing. We just need to communicate better.
New Hampshire is the only New England state that hasn't decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana. Now, you said you're not willing to consider that. Can you tell us why?
Absolutely. So I sat on the drug task force this last year. In this budget, we have spent 75% more than in the last budget, all told $101.5 million on this issue in this budget. And when we were on the drug task force, we heard from law enforcement, we heard from medical professionals, and we heard from recovering addicts that marijuana is a gateway drug. Why in the middle of a crisis we would think about decriminalizing marijuana makes no sense to me, and it really calls in question to me the common sense and the good judgment of two of the candidates who believe, at least on the Republican side, that believe that's okay to do. Now, in the last session, we heard that decriminalization was causing, you know, young people to have a black mark on their record. And certainly we don't, you know, people make mistakes and you want to forgive that and you don't want it to follow them the rest of their lives. So I heard that and I sat down with the county attorney and law enforcement and we worked on legislation, two companion bills that addressed those issues that we heard last time about how decriminalization was causing problems for small amounts of marijuana. We dealt with it. We took care of it. And this governor signed it into law.
Polls show that the majority of Granite Staters, and in fact, the majority of Americans, are favoring legalization, at least in some part, or loosening of marijuana laws across the country. How do you speak to that?
I would disagree wholeheartedly with that. I would have to see how the question on that poll was asked, but it makes no sense. And I just, when you hear, again, we're spending this kind of money on this issue, and we hear from the people on the front lines that this is a problem. Why would we think about decriminalizing or legalizing? Makes no sense to me. Two arguments they used in one of the more recent debates was that our jails are being filled up with people who are in for small amounts of marijuana. I talked to the county attorneys and law enforcement. That's not true. It's not true.
What have they said to you?
What's that?
What have they said to you?
The law enforcement?
Yeah.
That the folks who are there in jail are there for parole violations or other offenses that small amounts of marijuana might be show up, but that's not the reason that they're in jail. The other reason we heard that we needed to decriminalize marijuana is because our crime lab was backed up. They couldn't get to all the cases. So I called the head of the crime lab and asked that question. And he said, yes, we have a backup, but the backup is because of fentanyl and heroin cases. And we do have cases, he said, we do have cases of marijuana that we have to process, but they're large amounts of marijuana. They're not talking about the small amounts of marijuana. And so back to your question of the polls, I just wouldn't accept it. Colorado is having all kinds of problems. And I think we need to watch what's happening there. And in fact, what's happening there is affecting the state of New Hampshire by the types of the marijuana that's coming into this state now, according to my discussion with somebody on the Border Patrol.
Senator Jeanne Forrester, thank you for the time.
Thank you.